There are basically two kinds of zombies. The oldest is the voodoo zombie, a person, perhaps walking dead, perhaps incapacitated living, a creature with no will of their own, mindlessly performing the commands of their Bokor, the magician who created them. But since 1968, zombie has meant something else as well. With the film Night of the Living Dead, filmmaker George Romero created a new creature, a mindless corpse that walked and sought out the flesh of the living. And tonight, we're going to talk with Harvard medical doctor Stephen Schlossman about this kind of zombie, the Romero zombie, its plausibility, its popularity, and other cerebral matters.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with my co-hosts, Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolzno, we talk about monsters and the facts behind the legends. Today, we're covering one of my very favorite monsters, the Romero-style zombie. Based on the films of Romero and the many, many knockoffs and imitators, the Romero zombie is a shambling, animated dead person with an insatiable lust for the flesh of the living. Its bite is infectious, turning its victims into more ravenous monsters. It can only be stopped by destroying its brain. I'm a zombie fan. I've lost count of how many Walking Dead films I've seen, but there's been a pop culture resurgence of this creature lately. Many, many direct-to-video films plus high production value series from the BBC and AMC, and major motion pictures with wide theatrical releases such as Shaun of the Dead and Zombieland have provided a smorgasbord of viewing entertainment for those who enjoy the terror of being stalked by the living dead. I plan to do several episodes about zombies over the next year, but I wanted to kick it off with a bit of zombie lit. In the book The Zombie Autopsies, author Stephen Schlossman takes on the zombie and tries to present them as quasi-plausible medical scenarios, not to convince you that zombies are real, but to provide a gore-covered canvas with which to paint a picture of human physiology. Besides, if you're like me, you know perfectly well that zombies aren't real. They can't be. Absolutely no way zombies could be real. But I still walk swiftly from my car to the front door on foggy nights, and of course I keep a crowbar, some food, and a case of water in the attic. Just in case. Just in case.
Monster Talk.
Alright, tonight we're interviewing Steve Schlossman. Dr. Steve Schlossman, is that right?
For my mother's sake, that would make her very happy.
Yeah. Okay, super. All right. And you are currently a physician at Harvard?
That's correct.
And I'm talking to you because of your new book, The Zombie Autopsies, which I just finished reading last night. So, Steve, tell us about your day job and how it impacted your book.
I'm an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and at Massachusetts General Hospital. I'm the co-director of medical student education in psychiatry for Harvard Medical School and the associate director of training for child psychiatry. So I'm a clinical educator. I was looking sort of, I think unconsciously more than anything else, for a back door to make neuroscience kind of fascinating in a way that folks weren't expecting. So I've used it in a teaching way, which has been really, really fun and gratifying. Even folks like the National Academy of Sciences have had me give lectures about neuroscience using the construct of the cinematic zombie, which seems completely silly and ridiculous, except it actually sort of works. And that's been probably the most gratifying part of it, and also the easiest bridge between what I do now and you know, the creation of this novel.
Nice. Can I just say, that's actually the premise of our entire show, is that monsters are just a fabulous springboard to talk about science.
Oh, it's perfect. No, I totally agree with you. I mean, I think the overlapping Venn diagram of sort of high and low brow, especially with regard to horror and monster and science, is so ripe and so underutilized. So I think it's great you're doing it.
So, Steve, how did you become so interested in zombies?
It's a good question. So I've always loved horror movies since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Been a big fan, not of the slasher movies, not movies with real people who do really mean things. I mm-hmm. like the movies with fictional characters, so I don't have to be quite frightened. So I want to lead with the important caveat that zombies do not exist. I know that will disappoint some people out there, but I've had enough people say, are you saying they're real? And they are not real. Zombies are fictional constructs, which makes them fun. What happened is a movie theater here in Boston, the Coolidge Corner Theater, which is an independent movie theater, does this thing called Science on the Screen. They ask people to give talks before they show movies. So they'll have like a physicist talk about moving light speed before they show Star Trek.
Nice.
It's a really cool program. They just got a Sloan Foundation grant. Some movie theaters all over the country are doing it. They called me, asked me if I would do one, and kind of on a whim, because I just watched Night of the Living Dead for the 10 billionth time and loved it. I said, how about a zombie movie? And I thought they would say, come on, get real. But they were so into it. This was back in 2009. So I spent the whole summer renting zombie movies, and they were all tax write-offs, which was incredibly cool, too, because that was
well
work.
Well done, sir. Well done.
That was what I thought. So then I wrote a fake medical paper about especially the slow, shambling zombies that people like George Romero made famous. That's the zombie construct that interests me most. It's actually the one I find most frightening, too. And then we watched Night of the Living Dead at this big movie theater, and I gave a lecture beforehand, and that kind of went viral, no pun intended, online. And that led to the creation of this book. Basically, the people at Grand Central Publishing called me and said, would you write a novel? So that's the story.
Well, let me pick up on that. Now, you know, we talked a little bit before about, the educational aspect of these things. And as you pointed out, it's fun if you can educate people while talking about zombies. Because, I mean, how cool is that? So what will readers and lay people learn about neurology or about physiology from your novel?
A lot, I hope. I mean, I'll give you a quick anecdote, then I'll answer it more specifically. Within the book, there are clues. So if you read the book, they don't quite come to a resolution, and I'm not giving anything away. It's not like a big surprise that the zombie story doesn't have a happy ending. So there are hints in the book as to the missing bug that's been recombinantly designed by these evil hedge fund managers, basically, to destroy the world. Actually, they don't want to destroy the world. They want to bet at the against the market as it plunges and then fix the world and then gets out of hand. In the book, there are clues. One kid so far has figured it out. He emailed me. I spoke at the Annapolis Book Fair. He emailed me. He nailed the virus. He looked it up. He did Google searches. This 12-year-old kid. And first, I made sure his mom was cool with him reading it because the book has the F-bomb and things like that. And then I didn't want anybody to get upset. And I sent him a little zombie action figure, which was really fun. So one thing that's been really neat is not only have I taught medical students and science teachers, I've taught 12-year-old kids now with this topic, which I just feel really happy about. The things you can teach, you can start just from observational medicine, which is the beginning of all science, is just taking a look. So if you watch Night of the Living Dead and you see those shambling, you know, zombies shuffling about with that kind of dead stare in their face, if you're a physician, your first thought is you wouldn't try and knock their heads off with a baseball bat. You'd hope someone brought them to the emergency room and you would try to observe and figure out what's wrong with them. So you notice things. You notice they don't walk well, for example. And that then starts you thinking, well, what region of the brain is responsible for balance and for dopamine secretion to make basically your muscles move? They don't seem to think real well. They can't even open the damn window. So there must be a region of the brain that's responsible for solving, you know, semi-complex problems. And they're really, really hungry. And it turns out there's regions of the brain that are responsible for hunger. Now, there's other parts of the body that could be responsible for hunger, too. You might have a tapeworm. You might have malabsorption. But if you're teaching medical students, you would want to ask them the differential. If this guy came into your emergency room in restraints, probably because otherwise he'd try to bite off your nose or something, he comes in the emergency room, you would say, what do you want to know? What do you want to know about him? Do you want to talk screen? What observations have you made? And kind of take it from there.
It's a zombie triage.
Yeah,
it would be zombie trish. Now, yeah. If there were a zombie apocalyptic plague out there, hopefully the CDC would start to notice patterns, just as we do with things like SARS or with H1N1 or with West Nile, for that matter. All of these new bugs that keep showing up, we learn quickly how to differentiate them from the things that they so often mimic. So SARS was a coronavirus. It's the kind of virus that causes a cold, you know, millions of times a year. But for whatever reason, reasons that aren't still well understood, SARS got nasty fast and picked on a bunch of countries in Asia, and for whatever reason went after Toronto too. So it gets you to sort of think out loud about how these phenomena take place and to do exactly what you just said, to triage, to say, okay, this is a regular cold. This ain't. This is SARS. This is a regular person who seems to have taken too much of an illicit substance. This isn't. This is a zombie.
Zombies, or at least the Romero style, seem to offer two vectors for fear. You got cannibalism and infection. Yep. In your story, infection seems to be the prevailing concern. Now, why did you decide not to do the typical zombies are after me type story?
I think for two reasons. I find infection more frightening. So I wanted to, this was sort of taking the thing that scares me by the horns and wrestling with it. I have little kids. I'm genuinely resentful of things like West Nile virus. Like, it just bums me out that it didn't used to be here and now it is. And I have to think about it and worry about it. And I know it's an incredibly rare thing for somebody to get West Nile encephalitis, but it bums me out. So I started running with the kind of paranoia that I'm likely to follow down too. And it certainly pervades the press when pandemics occur. And to me, it's that infectious process that's so frightening. The idea that, is this a cold or is this the end of all mankind? And it feels like there ought to be some space in the middle there. But often when pandemics come around, we don't put a lot of space in the middle. So I just found it more of a compelling story. The other thing to keep in mind is that in Romero's first movie, in Night of the Living Dead, they never really say what caused the zombies. There's a hint that it's radiation, but George will tell you he was very careful not to make it clear.
Steve, how much zombie research did you do prior to writing your book?
Well, given that they're fictional characters, I get to make up some of my own research, which is fun. So there's in the back of the book, there's the first article in the New England Journal of Medicine about zombies, which of course has not yet been published because the date is 2012 or 13 or something. So, but I wrote it in New England Journal of Medicine style, and the bibliography is filled with both fake and real articles. So articles that I made up, as well as articles that exist in real life that have really been written. Articles about prions causing brain inflammation, articles about how prions become more infectious in acidic environments, articles about how diseases spread, for example. So I did a lot of research sort of outside the psychiatric and neuroscience realm about infectious diseases. And then I did a fair amount of research about what bugs can invade the brain and mimic the symptoms that we see in the cinematic, not the West African or Haitian zombies, but the cinematic zombies. For example, there are viruses that invade the ventromedial hypothalamus and make you hungry, make you abnormally hungry, ignore your satiety regions and eat.
Wow.
Cool.
What are those?
They're ice cream-based viruses. They're right. Horrible.
Ice cream, chocolate, and sometimes, you know, associated with illicit substances in movies like Fast Times at Richmond High. there's a virus called – there's a bunch of them, but the one that you read most often about is there's a virus called the Borna virus, B-O-R-N-A. And it often hangs around in animals and makes occasional animal-to-human jumps. So there's some literature. There was an outbreak in Switzerland, staggering cat disease that then jumped to humans. There was an outbreak in the UK. Rarely are they fatal to humans, but when they are introduced artificially into lab animals or when humans occasionally do get them, they eat and eat and eat and eat, sometimes to near fatal conditions.
Fascinating.
Do they put on weight or?
Yeah. So it doesn't increase metabolism. Well, it's a great question. So it's not like a tapeworm where you would eat and eat and eat, but you wouldn't absorb anything. And then the reason you're hungry is because the tapeworm's taking away all your nutritious value. You eat and you absorb. It's basically a binge. It's a nonstop binge, but it's not driven by the sort of desire to discharge anxiety the way binge is in binge eating disorder. It's driven by infection of the ventromedial hypothalamus. You know, there are other syndromes as well. There's some genetic syndromes, Prader-Willi disease, for example, that have the same presentation. But I was looking for a way that you could actually catch this thing. And then I had to, for it to kind of meet the criteria for a quickly spreading pandemic that would become, that would take on apocalyptic levels, it had to be airborne. I talked with a lot of ID docs about this, and the model of the zombie biting you and then you getting it just wouldn't work. We would at some point keep our heads, get a fence around it, and it'd be relatively easily solved.
Earlier you mentioned that your book doesn't necessarily have a happy ending. Speaking of happy endings, did you get into the physiology of zombie sex?
You are not the first person to ask that. That may be disappointing to you. I don't know. But it was a lot of folks have asked about that. Do zombies reproduce, or do they have, you know, given that the bug in this book eats your brain down to its most primitive regions, down to the amygdala, which is kind of more science fiction than not, because if you went down past to the amygdala, it would be awfully hard to keep moving about. But there are ways we could think of it happening. The amygdala is responsible for fight and flight, and many folks would say for lust, too. Not lust in the way we would conceptualize it in looking at like a movie star, but lust in the way a crocodile would conceptualize it, the kind of primitive desire to reproduce. So folks who have read this book have said, but wait a minute, you know, your zombies, they shouldn't be just out there eating and attacking. They ought to be looking for a way to make more of themselves as well. The way I've sort of dealt with that, besides trying to just not think about it because it's sort of a gross idea, is to say if the ventromedial hypothalamus is the overwhelmingly infected area, then all they can think about is how hungry they are. That's the only thought there. So their amygdala is screaming fight, flight, or lust, except the ventromedial hypothalamus is saying hunger, hunger, hunger. And so those two things go together and lead to eating, basically, lead to chasing anything that moves.
Or is it that you just couldn't come up with really good zombie erotica?
It was really hard to come up with good zombie erotica.
Hard. Well, yeah. Well done, sir. Well done.
Talking to a shrink, too.
Well, you can do it for vampires, and why not zombies?
Well, but actually, that's a really good point. One of the things that I think makes zombies so much more frightening, I love vampire stories. I've written about vampires. I wrote an academic article about Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I love blood. But vampires are, by definition, libidinally driven. They are, when a vampire goes after you, he or she is after you. It's about you. At least that's what we're led to believe. And it makes you feel kind of special. Even if they're seducing you, you feel special. If a zombie wants to eat my guts and I step to the right, the zombie's going to eat the person next to me's guts. It's not about my guts at all. My guts are not special. And if your guts are going to be eaten, you would at least like it to be personal. It's the personal nature of it, I think, that makes the zombie genre so interesting.
I'm looking forward to your next book, Zombies. They're not that into you.
Right. That's a great, but I have a
love story, romance novel.
It's like a virus. The virus doesn't care. It just looks for a host. That's all.
Yeah. I've often actually, you know, we're probably going to do some episodes, multiple episodes about zombies, because I want to talk about things like, the zombie ants, real world scenarios where disease really changes the behavior of things.
Is that you're talking about the one where the fungus gets inside their brain?
Yeah. And then there's the disease is bloodborne. Cats get it. If rats get it, then they go and lose their fear behavior.
You're thinking of toxoplasmosis.
Yes, exactly. Right.
The reason, like when women are pregnant, they can't clean the litter box and things like that. It doesn't always lead to sort of, you know, out and out aggression and rage, but it can. That can be one of the presentations. Part of it has to do with where the cysts themselves situate in the brain.
Right. And I guess what I was getting at was that if diseases or those sort of real world things that seem to affect behavior, it made me always imagine that a really effective venereal disease would drive you to more libidinous behavior. But I haven't ever seen any studies that would indicate that's actually happening. But, you know, if gonorrhea really wanted to be successful, well, it would just, you know, also make you incredibly amorous, right?
No, it's a great point. So from an evolutionary perspective, you would want your bug not only to be very good at infecting you, but to change the behavior of the host so that it's more likely to infect other people. What happened with gonorrhea is evolution doesn't work for the best choice. It just works for the good enough choice. So gonorrhea worked good enough to not need to have an evolutionary adaptation. Now, if there happens to be a random mutation at some point in the future in some science fiction-y way that would make you more likely to feel heightened libido, that gonorrhea would outcompete the other gonorrheas, and it would go forward and prosper.
Exactly.
In the book, which is sort of hinted at the end, the evil hedge fund investors who hire people to invent this monster virus, I wanted to pick an easy villain, so that's why I went with hedge fund investors. They think to themselves, okay, let's make a bug that by definition makes its host want to spread it. So the behavior of a zombie actually lends itself to passing the bug on to other people, but it's going to have to be something other than biting, because if all they do is bite, it would be pretty easy just to round them up.
So how did real-world epidemiology come into play in the zombie autopsies?
A couple ways. There's another gentleman, professor of mathematics, who does disease modeling. He does modeling of epidemiologic outbreaks. His name is Robert Smith, with a question mark at the end of it. His name is literally Robert Smith, because he added the question mark to distinguish himself from all the other Robert Smiths out there.
So from the cure. Legally,
he changed his name. He is a mathematician who has looked at, used the construct of how zombie bugs spread as a means of studying other diseases like human papillomavirus, for example. He's at the University of Ottawa. So I spoke some with him. I met him actually at a National Academy of Science event, and we sort of talked about the various ways that diseases spread. And also, I have friends in infectious diseases here at the hospital. Part of my day job is to be the consultant of the transplant service, so I hang out a lot with the ID docs, since we see a lot of immunosuppressed kids. One of the things they're always interested in are early warning signs of what are novel bugs, or what are things that you normally wouldn't pay much attention to, but you need to in kids who are immunosuppressants that can get ahead of them very fast. So I asked how those things are set up. It turns out they're set up very regionally. So different cities will have different public health initiatives that allow them to spot things like swine flu, for example, more readily.
Obviously, this is your book fits very well in with the current and recent past interest in and fear of zombies. What do you think it is that makes people so intrigued by zombies or scared of zombies, given the fact that they're sort of so outside the realm of our everyday life? I mean, they're not quite extraterrestrial, but they're certainly nothing that most of us would necessarily think is going to jump out at us from a closet.
It's a really neat question, and everyone's got their own theory about this. I have a couple of ideas, and then I had a chance to think about it in writing this book. One is I think that, and most people would agree, that our life is kind of increasingly, our modern life is increasingly zombie-esque in kind of cliched ways. So examples I've given are waiting at the Department of Motor Vehicles, where you become a number and you kind of shuffle about in low lights and you're hungry for donuts and that's all they got, and you wait for 3 or 4 hours. So there's this way that we feel just disconnected when you're on hold forever, and they say this call is monitored for quality assurance, but it really can't be, because they're monitoring every call, so there's no possible way your call matters. So it's that lack of personal meaning that seems to characterize the way we might feel increasingly disconnected that I think has maybe brought the kind of zombie construct to the forefront. There's also the idea that things don't look like what they are. So there's that zombie thing that happens in every movie where the guy can't quite get himself to pull the trigger on what used to be his girlfriend and sure looks like his girlfriend, but it's just a shell now. It's not his girlfriend anymore. And the shooter man, she's already gone. I can't do it. She might not be in. At the end, he waits too long and he gets eaten. That very thing we've seen used as a metaphor for, like, when the real estate market collapsed, they talked about zombie banks and zombie mortgages, things that pretended to be mortgages but weren't, things that were banks that looked like banks but really weren't, loans that really weren't loans. So there's this idea that things can masquerade as something that they're not, and we wouldn't know it. With a vampire, even before he or she shows you her fangs, you get a sense that there's something, I think there's a chase going on, there's some kind of game going on. Zombies kind of take you by surprise. They just kind of shamble up to you, and you're not expecting it, I think. I think that's kind of the beauty of a movie like Shaun of the Dead, where he can go in and out of that grocery store so many times and doesn't even notice, because thought that weird to see a bunch of people shuffling about early in the morning.
That's classic. It's classic.
It is classic. I agree.
So, science question. Prions form about a third of the zombie infection in your book.
They do.
Can you tell us about a prion infection versus a viral or bacterial infection?
Sure. Prions are fascinating and creepy as hell. prion is a shortened word that stands for proteinaceous infection, and that's because they are merely proteins. And the important part about that is that means they're not technically alive, at least the way we've defined life. They don't have any nucleic acid. They don't have RNA. They don't have DNA. They don't reproduce in the way that we think of reproduction, even for microorganisms. Nevertheless, when a prion gets into your brain, it changes it to Swiss cheese, basically. It causes a spongiform encephalopathy, and it multiplies. So it's kind of a mystery how it does that and why it does that. It's not well understood. There are many theories, but there are many competing theories. So at this point, the pathophysiology of why prions are so effective at sort of eating through the brain in an almost worm-like fashion, especially given that they're not technically alive, it's kind of up for grabs. They were first discovered in Papua New Guinea among folks who ate each other's brains, either for ritualistic reasons or as cannibals, and it leads to general insanity, thought disorder, motoric problems, myoclonic movements, where when your body shifts really quickly, and then eventually death. It's also the organism or the protein that's responsible, I guess you would call it the contagion, that's responsible for things like mad cow disease. And there, the big mystery was suddenly we started having hoofed animals developing a prion-related illness that had to have been in the soil all along. So what made it more infectious? And one of the theories is that the increasing acidity of the soil as a function of climate change caused the prions to twist and fold. And twisted and folding prions, we know, make them more capable of eating through brain material.
Ah, that explains a lot of the things happening in the book. Okay.
Right. So, and that's the mess in the book they're in. So they create this artificial alkalosis, metabolic alkalosis, where they increase their own pH, which also feels crappy. So they end up feeling like zombies in an attempt to ward off the progression of the zombie bug.
So this is like that Creutzfeldt.
Yeah, Creutzfeldt Jakob, second gentleman who was responsible for was named Jacobs. So Creutzfeldt and Jakob made this discovery in Papua New Guinea. Other docs have noticed it in other places. Scrapies is another version of this that you see in sheep. And then every now and then you'll see this in a medical student who gets it from a cadaver during dissections. I mean, this is increasingly rare as we've gotten much, much, much more careful. But it's the thing that's noticeable in the book and meant to sort of stir up a little bit of horror is that the prions have to make their way to your brain in order to be infectious. And they do have a predilection to get to your brain once you've swallowed them. So they get absorbed through the bloodstream and they like to go to the brain. But getting to the brain through breathing, an aerosolized version of them, that when I wrote the book had not yet existed. It just so happens that in the last year, there was an article in JAMA and also in Popular Science that talked about aerosolizing prions, and mice in laboratory conditions are 100% infected when that happens, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask, it seems like there's quite a few, or at least a fair number of doctors who want to write novels, want to be novelists, and of course lawyers as well. You look at people like Crichton and
Grisham, John Grisham.
Grisham, yes, there you go.
Turow too.
Yeah, this Turow. Yeah, I mean, take your pick. What do you? Is there something specific to those sorts of professions? Do you think it is, or just sort of do you think everybody has a novel in them, and some people have more ability to act on that? Or
It's a great question. First of all, I think not everybody has a novel. Probably everybody has a screenplay, from my experience. But bad joke. I'm sorry. So the I was an English major. I was a high school English teacher. I love stories. I've always loved stories. When I went to medical school, I knew I would be a psychiatrist, in part because I love the stories. I'm very aware that these are real people with real issues, and so I take that work extremely seriously. But having said that, I've not ever met a psychiatrist who doesn't want to write a story at some point. And then when you start kind of scratching the surface of physicians, especially medical students, before they find out that the time they get with their patients is increasingly limited, the stories we get are such privileges to hear, and they become kind of kernels for, they're reflective of the human condition. So we have an opportunity then to kind of tell these stories in displacement. It's a way of coping with our own work, and also a way of being creative. With attorneys, I don't happen to be an attorney, but I know that attorneys also hear very privileged information all of the time, and sometimes not the easiest information to hear. So one of the ways you cope with it is you put it in displacement and you tell stories about it.
It's almost, it might almost be an expected offshoot of what you're doing.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, when I teach medicine, I tell the students to really think of their patients as storytellers. The patient knows what's going on with them better than anybody else. And so before you do your physical exam, before you order a bazillion tests, let your patient talk. Let them tell you the story. Because that's where 90% of the diagnosis is made. And that's actually where the fun of being a doctor is, too.
Written quite a few nonfiction articles in addition to the novel. Which do you find more challenging, the fiction or the nonfiction?
You mean to write for me to write?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I find writing the fiction unbelievably rewarding, but also more challenging. I'm 2/3 of the way done with my second novel right now, which I've gotten very good responses from my agent and from the publisher. And I keep getting stuck. I keep saying, well, if this happens to this character, I don't know what's going to happen with this other character. I mean, it's very hard to sort of tell stories within stories within stories. If I'm writing a nonfiction piece, it's like writing an essay. And essays have a clear arc to them. So it's they're related beasts, but they're different enough. And I think they lend, at least for me, they one lends to the other.
Could the world survive an infection-based zombie outbreak?
Hope so. They're fictional. But, and I keep saying that because people keep asking. The CNN did this Twitter chat, and we finally had to say, they don't exist. We had to put that in big capital letters on the Twitter chat on Monday. I think the world could survive. Here's where I think the world could get into trouble. We would see a bunch of shambling around corpses, and it would scare the bejesus out of us, which would make sense. That's an appropriate response to shambling around corpses that are biting people's arms off and things like that. And in response to very, very intense fear, we often fail to use our frontal lobes in ways that we would be proud of later. So I know that sounds preachy, but that's the key to every zombie movie. You watch these zombie movies and you see these, especially the slow-moving zombies, and you see these slow shambling about zombies. And in the beginning, all they do is bash their heads in and shoot them in the head. And they actually even seem to enjoy it a little bit. But that kind of behavior, I think, takes its toll on us as humans. I think when we shoot something, we want it to be angry about us shooting it, especially, you know, and want it to kill us back. And the fact that they don't reflect any emotion back usually makes us behave even worse and worse and worse. I would think we could survive, we could keep our head. So we could say, okay, this is a bug, it's an infection, we've dealt with infections before, let's get our very best scientists out there, let's quarantine where we need to quarantine, let's keep safe what we need to keep safe, and let's study it. Let's not grab for the shotguns or the machetes or all of that, let's actually grab for our frontal lobes. That's our best weapon.
Go right for the powerful ones. Of course, the title of the book is The Zombie Autopsies. Do you do autopsies, or where did you get the details from that? Are you,
I don't do autopsies. I did a few in medical school. They're hard. They're fascinating. But, you know, they're also there's a person there. So I was a big fan of the X-Files, and I will still watch old episodes. And I love, you know, all the scenes where Scully kind of is boringly taking the organs out and throwing them in the scale and weighing them. And I always see that as a kind of defense against the intensity of what you're doing. If you read like Da Vinci's old stuff, he was always reluctant to cut open a person, even though he did it all the time in order to make the anatomy clear. So I talk to pathologists that I, you know, get to work with to sort of understand basic autopsy procedures. And I also wanted to work with this construct of the walking dead. If they're dead, then any surgery on them is by definition an autopsy. So there's this kind of trick of language there that I was trying to play with, that they're not really dead. They're just declared ecumenically dead in the book I wrote. A bunch of religious leaders get together and say, geez, they're as good as dead. And that is very similar to the much more difficult conversations that happen all the time in real medicine, where we have to decide who's worth keeping on the vent and who's not. Those horrible, awful, existentially profound discussions, they're much easier to learn about in the displacement of a zombie novel than in the real world. So even the idea of a zombie autopsy makes you say, oh, well, good, they must be dead. But then in the book, they're clearly not dead. They're watching it happen as you're doing it.
Right. So just to be clear, you're admitting that you have not actually autopsied zombies. Is that right?
I'm absolutely going on the record that never once have I done an autopsy on a zombie.
And no zombies were harmed in the making of your novel?
no zombies were harmed in the making of the novel. You know, there is an important point here. If you go online, the publisher hired a wonderful filmmaker, a guy named Hugo Perez, who's a really talented guy, and we made both a trailer and then a teaser for the book. And it was really fun to do. And I ordered some sheep brains from a biological supply company that, you know, go to biology labs in high schools and colleges for dissection. And we ended up having to put a disclaimer on the video: these are not human brains. No, I mean, it's a really small brain, so it would have to be like a child brain, which is like, bro, there's no way I would ever do that. People were like, how could you do this with human brains? Like, well, first of all, it's really tiny. So, I mean, it's bigger than you would expect for how dumb you expect sheep to be. Having said that, it's clearly not a human brain. But we had to put on the video, no human brains were harmed and no humans were harmed in this either.
Right, so, because they're zombies now.
Right. But neither zombies nor humans were harmed. Now, in the book, there is an ethical guideline. You're allowed to dissect stage 4 disease people, but not stage 3. And one of the things they're kind of working with is the idea that in order to learn more about the disease, they're going to probably have to do experiments on folks who are at stage 3. And that's very ethically questionable because stage 3 is still realizes who and what they are. So it's this moment of kind of, again, existentially driven angst for all of the scientists as they struggle to save the world.
Okay, just a very new, I guess this is an overly specific question, but the in the book you talked about how to slice a brain as though it were a loaf of bread. Is that actually based on real advice you've been given? Or
yep, that's word for word.
It seemed awfully realistic. It really did.
That was. I mean, you know, you never know. I'm not the only one who heard. I mean, I remember everybody in my medical school class sort of chuckling when this was heard. And I've talked to people who've gone to other medical schools and have also heard the same thing. So you never know if the neuropathologists say that because it really is like cutting bread. And it's not unlike cutting bread, but there's other analogies you could use. Or if they say it kind of to be gross and gory and get you all excited. It is like cutting bread in that if you try to just push the knife down, you're gonna sort of serrate it. You're gonna mess it up, not get a clean cut. But if you go back and forth, the way you do in cutting bread on Shabbos, for example, then you get a nice clean slice.
There seems like some real life politics in your book. So how realistic do you think that is? For example, in terms of legal classifications of persons as no longer human or zombies.
I think it's very, I mean, it hasn't happened yet. I don't think we have any disease where we've been willing to say this person doesn't exist as human. But we are always playing with this notion in medicine about where we draw the lines, where we put our lines, where we call something pathologic and where we call it normal. It's especially an issue in psychiatry and what I do. But it happens in all of culture. And those decisions are both a function of gathered data through very careful scientific inquiries, but also through culture and policy and religious beliefs. So to that extent, I think it's not that far off. I hope that we never get to a place where we say, you know, this person is as good as not being human. We know historically that we've been more than willing to classify enemies as subhuman in some way. That's one of the ways that allows us to go to war. And that was another idea I was sort of thinking about in the book.
Dehumanization and...
Right.
I was going to say, it reminded me of the Terry Schiavo case quite a bit.
The Terry Schiavo was exactly on my mind. Thank you for bringing it up. That's the case that came to mind when I was...
Okay, cool. I put a book note in my Kindle. So
yeah. No, I think it's really cool that you thought of that. That was a horrible story. I mean, not horrible in that... I mean, I felt horrible for the family. I felt horrible for the situation. And I felt horrible for kind of the culture. I don't know that there was a good answer to it. And though the lack of a good answer is something that we have a very hard time dealing with, and the irony of modern medicine is there's this illusion that we have good, straightforward answers all the time, when as a matter of fact, we almost never do. So the Terry Schiavo case really brought that to light, in part because it was so well publicized, and in part because it brought to light this question of when is somebody as good as dead? Like when is it not worth their being considered alive?
I'm still sort of stuck on the brain slicing thing. Mm-hmm. What would human brains taste like? I know that people sometimes eat animal brains. I personally don't, but I do know some people do eat animal brains.
My family does.
Assuming that they're based on the same sorts of materials, do you have some idea of what brains would taste like?
I don't. Other than that, there's a fair amount of fat. So there might be that kind of, again, I really don't know. I'm sort of thinking out loud here.
I can actually speak to that, Ben. My I have relatives who farmer, you know, background. They're the I guess my, not my father's generation, but the generation before that. A lot of them are still around. And happily, hey guys, I'm sure you're listening. Anyway, they normally would eat hog brains when they killed hogs as like a treat almost, and they would scramble them in the frying pan. And my aunt, who's the only person I've ever asked about this, said to her they taste a lot like regular scrambled eggs.
That's what I've read. I've read they taste like scrambled eggs, but a little bit sweeter, a little bit kind of fattier. You know, kind of like a good breakfast food.
Is there anything unique to human physiology that would lead us to think that human brains taste any different, or is it logical to assume that they would taste like, you know, pig brains?
I think it's from what I know, I can't think of a reason they would taste any different from pig brains. They probably would taste different, I would think, from lower organisms like crocodiles, for example, because in fact, because there's just so much more gray matter involved. Yeah. But I'm not sure. Frankly, no one's ever asked that before either.
We'll have to interview a chef next time.
Well, I'm just wondering because, I mean, isn't there a lot of collection of glucose in the brain?
Yeah. So one of the reasons there's glucose and there's carbohydrates, one of the reasons that people have said that it tastes more sweet, at least my understanding, and I've myself never tasted brains, is the fact that the glucose and the fat would sort of combine in that nice fatty, you know, smell that you get when you have sausages, for example.
And there's been so many zombie films lately. And actually, before the interview, I went and looked online. There's a list on Wikipedia. This surprised me. They list, and I'm not sure I agree with every selection they have in here, but more than 650 zombie films, if you can believe that.
Were these international as well as
US? They are, yeah. I mean, but they go back to like White Zombie and I Walked with a Zombie.
Yeah.
Of course, obviously, Night of Living Dead is the one that really turned around the genre, in my opinion. Although, truthfully, I've been reading a lot of literature lately, so I kind of always thought of Romero as the inventor of the shambling horror that eats you. But I've been reading Robert E. Howard horror stories, and I guess even back in the EC Comics type stuff too, which was actually after that. You know, the sort of shambling Walking Dead, not Haitian zombie, was still out there. But okay, so what my question was, did you watch AMC's The Walking Dead?
Oh yeah. In fact, I even got asked to write a chapter about it, about that, the last episode when they go.
That was what I was going to ask you about. You know, that CDC is here in Atlanta, but they actually filmed that at the Cobb Energy Center, which is like a performing arts center, which is right near where I work. It's very funny to drive by there.
Oh, so you got the building that was blown to pieces? Is that right? Because it didn't look like the CDC to me.
Yeah, no. Yeah, the building that's blown to pieces is actually where you would go see opera or performing arts. It's very fancy.
I found that last episode. First of all, I love the show. I thought the show began like every other zombie movie. They sort of set the stage. But then it really took off and was about the characters and the relationships, which is really what zombie movies are about. I've gotten to be friends with George Romero and all of this, which has been just a joy. He's been a marvelous guy and a great mentor and just a great friend. And he always says zombies are the thing that happens. It could be a hurricane, it could be a tornado. He happens to like the zombies, so that's what he does. When he made Night of the Living Dead, he wasn't even thinking zombies. He called it Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Yeah.
Publicist changed it, and then somebody in one of the magazines called them zombies. So he figured, it works. I'll go with it. Before Romero, and also before some of the literature you just referred to, and also books like I Am Legend, the original, which was like 1956 or something, the first novel, nobody was afraid of zombies. They were afraid of becoming a zombie. And the big shift came with the idea that you could sort of catch the zombie bug or be turned into a zombie in some way. That was the shift, I think, that people did before George, but George really made famous with Night of the Living Dead. And by the way, he never made a dime off that movie.
I know. It's very sad.
It is sad. He didn't. He just was he was a cameraman for Mr. Rogers at the time, and he wanted to make an anti-war movie. So that's what it was.
It is an astonishing little film, even now.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Again, we've talked about the different types of zombies. Now, do you prefer the slow zombies or the fast zombies?
This is the debate. Last year at Spooky Empire, which is a horror enthusiast convention in Orlando, I was asked to do an Oxford-style debate where I would resolve the affirmative that the slow-moving zombies are scarier. And the guy debating against me, who went by the name of the Grim Reaper, I don't think that was his real name, he debated that it was the fast-moving zombies that were scarier. I much prefer slow-moving zombies. I think they're way scarier. I think having time to think is one of the scariest things humans can endure. Like, if something's running after me, then I'm going to run. And it's pretty straightforward. Or if it tries to hit me, I might hit it back. But if it's just shambling towards me ever so slowly, if I could eat a sandwich while getting out of the way, if I have time to do something like that, that to me is so much more frightening. It's that time. It's the not knowing when I can ever let my guard down.
The suspense.
Yeah, to me, that's what gets me. It was funny because in that debate, I tried, I made this argument. I talked about brain regions. And the other guy who was a lovely guy, really nice guy, he stood up and he said, "I don't know. When they chase me, they're pretty damn scary, and I'm going to run." This is argument. And it was a good argument, too.
I'm sorry, who won the debate?
Well, we did the clapping thing at the end. It looked like a tie, although afterwards I was told I probably lost. It's okay. It's okay. I still stand by my conviction.
I prefer the slow zombies as a survivor, right? I mean, right. I think I'd have a better chance because I'm kind of slow.
Was that in Zombieland cardio? That was one of the.
Yeah, it was. It was. And believe me, I need to work on my cardio. But I mean, you think about it, like so many people here in the South. I don't know. Have you ever played the Left 4 Dead video game?
Oh, it scares the poop out of me. But yes, I've
yes. I mean, it. I love that game. It's like being in a zombie movie, right? But yeah. I hate the fast zombies because I'm slow and I want. But at the same time, I don't think I could prevent myself from being a zombie hunter if they were real. You know, it's just I would have to.
Right. You have to go.
Unless they're fast, and then I'd be up in my attic. Right. So.
Right. Well, that's. I think the fast movie, it's a different. First of all, neurologically, I mean, thinking about how I would teach med students, I'll ask them. I will literally ask them. Okay. We've just watched a clip of Night of Living Dead. Let's look at a clip from 28 Days Later, knowing that many zombie purists will not consider the zombies or the infected in 28 Days Later zombies, probably including myself. But let's watch it because it definitely falls within the genre. It borrows from the genre. They're different. Tell me what's different about their brains. And they move fluidly with coordination. They hunt in pack behavior. So you can say a lot of things about their brain that you can't say about the Romero zombies as well. They're different. They're more sophisticated.
I want to audit your classes.
Yeah, no kidding.
I would love it if you could tell my dean that. That would be great.
Will do. So here's our final question we like to ask all of our guests. So Steve, what is your favorite monster?
Oh, that's such a loaded question at this point. Favorite monster, like from the monster movies, is that what you mean? Because I would say Sasquatch.
Any.
Any monster.
Any kind any monster, on the continuum.
Believe me, Sasquatch is our bread and butter.
I didn't know that. I love Sasquatch. I mean, I love zombies because of the zombie thing, but I grew up in the 70s, man, and I couldn't get enough of Sasquatch stories, and I truly miss them. I wish they were more often online. There's a great, very funny book, which you've probably seen, I Not Dead. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's totally worth reading about Sasquatch. So my favorite potentially fictional monster will still be Bigfoot. I think very he's good. A North American original.
Wow. That's great. Well, yeah. Dr. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. Today you heard from Harvard medical doctor and author Steven Schlossman discussing his new book, The Zombie Autopsies. A link to the book will be in the show notes, along with a link to the video trailer he produced. Also, we have a very cool piece of zombie art you can download, produced by the gruesomely talented Jeff Zornow, just for our show. Monster Talk's produced by Skeptic Magazine. When you're stocking your zombie safe room, you should consider putting in some issues of Skeptic Magazine. It's good for reading, and you can use it to start fires. But I must be honest, it is no substitute for toilet paper. You should stockpile that separately. Monster Talk is hosted by me, Blake Smith, and skeptical researchers and writers Ben Radford and Dr. Karen Stolznow. Links to their many interesting projects are in the bio links at skeptic.com under podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, why not give us a review at iTunes or share the show on your Twitter and Facebook accounts? And if you've just made a ton of money on the stock market by creating a super zombie virus, why not donate a little of that to our show with the donate link? All the money you donate will be used to buy hatchets, freeze-dried food and leather armor, and possibly a chainsaw. Theme music for Monster Talk was by Peach Stealing Monkeys. The opening music was a short selection from the film Dawn of the Dead, titled Figment. The music during the interview was produced by the very talented Symbian Project and used with permission. Links to these artists' music will be in the show notes. Thanks again for listening.
Skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.